You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2007 Frankfurt Avenue. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
We're doing this little this experiment for how to have these meetings and how to facilitate some dialogue, how to have some good conversation. It's just so nice to be able to do this with you, Gwen. You said you're a treasure to me. I met Gwen 20 years ago when I was 18, and since we've become friends, pastors together, even relatives in a lot of ways. And I want to tell, in case you don't know her, I'll just kind of give, it's not really your, I'm sorry, it won't be like your professionalism at this point, but these are the things to me that are just like, wow, here's Gwen. First of all, she's a trustworthy person. I've never heard anything from her that wasn't trustworthy. The authentic, from her experience, from her convictions, from her the revelation that she's received. She recently retired as an educator at Eastern University, where she had a couple different roles, training therapists, training psychologists, training people to work with concepts of how the brain and our spirit are connected, how to help people do some inner healing through good processes. She started Circle Counseling 20 years ago and has developed a really beautiful team of folks who are vocational healers in that particular practice. And she's been our teaching pastor for a long time. And let's see, another thing that I think that's really cool about you is that you sit on the Mennonite Central Committee U.S. Board of Directors. So she helps to listen to God's movement through our main arm of peace, relief, and development work internationally, to listen how God's moving, to make some visionary decisions and to help develop those the good work. So I definitely want to talk about some of those things, about, you know, grief and loss, and is therapy good for everyone? Am I in therapy too long? How does circle counseling work? About contemplative prayer, which has been, I know, sort of crucial to your own spirituality, your own process of transformation. And then you may have some questions that kind of come up for you. So hold on to them and bring it up when we have some talk back. But first, I think much more simply, would you just tell us about the spiritual soil that you grew up in? You became a Christian as a late teen, right? Now, how did you grow up and how did that process happen?
Well, I wasn't as far along as Josh was when he was 18. He was a wonder to behold. But when I was 16, I became a Christian. I offended my parents deeply by doing so, only because I think they thought I should have already been one, since they were taking me to a mainline kind of church. But I never heard anything about a relationship. Certainly didn't hear about God loving me. Thought the Bible was really boring. So I came by way of this revelation that God loved me, that Jesus was someone I could create a friendship with. That was a revelation for me. And kind of having a look back, that one's been solid.
That's cool. Maybe sort of connected to that, I know, in your story along the way, but what is it about swimming that you love so much? And I know you don't like to brag about how serious of a swimmer you were, but Gwen was an alternate for the United States Olympic team.
No, yeah. I missed the trials.
Missed the trials. She won a gold medal.
I did lose to Mark Spitz for me.
Michael Phelps is trash. what do you love about swimming?
Well, I could swim before I could walk. And I grew up in Southern California, so swimming was a thing that everybody did. And I think I think it was just a place that I found home. I went on to teach swimming. I put myself through college teaching swimming, did a lot of coaching of swimmers. I often laugh with my family and say, if I ever drown, you should suspect foul play. Because I just can't ever imagine being uncomfortable in water. And, you know, I was talking to Stacy, who's almost ready to deliver a baby, just between the two meetings tonight, and she was a little worried about labor, and I said, just imagine you're floating. And that's the way my whole life works. It always goes back to these water images. So I feel like God saved me by way of making an alternative environment available for me. I found being in that place, swimming the mile after mile after mile that I swam, to be safe in a world that didn't feel very safe to me and my original family.
That's really cool. You're a fun person to swim with, too. I feel safe swimming around here. You're not complaining like the roughhousing games that are going to get me hurt. I grew up with an older brother, so no, my swimming environments were necessarily like that. When did you start thinking about psychology and vocation that took you in that direction? Because that wasn't, when you were in high school, you weren't saying, no, I'm going to
study psychology. Among the many legacies of my family was a hatred for psychology. I'm old, right? I came to Christ in the late 60s. Got married in the middle of the 70s, started having kids, and was pretty involved in ministry, but there was a little bit of a strain that ran through, I think, some anxiety, especially that my mom experienced all through her life, undiagnosed. But, she was very suspicious of psychology. Actually, a lot of people have been suspicious of psychology through the years, and I think for some good reasons. We deal in the intangibles, after all. I'm hearing a chorus of my colleagues talking about how much effort they've put into research and measurable outcomes. But the reality is that we're dealing with the stuff of the unconscious. And although we can trace that in brain imagery now, it's still hard to talk about any firm realities related to that, other than that it is, that there is this unconscious part of our being. I think by becoming a Christian and then falling in love with Rod and diving into ministry in ways that we did, somewhere along the way, the Lord just made it evident to me that there was so much more going on in any individual's life than we understood, and that His saving of us was so much bigger than we dreamed, that I started reading folks like Nouwen and Brendan Manning, kind of did my little circle of trying to meet all these people and met a good number of them. And in the midst of reading these spiritual writers who also had training in psychology, I think that kind of opened the door to me. And I wasn't sure when or how I would do anything other than read stuff on my own. But when we moved to Philadelphia, we were near a whole bunch of programs, and so my kids were old enough to do a lot of things on their own, so I did grad school while my kids did high school, and did my doctorate while my kids did college, so that's how it worked.
You brought up the unconscious. And earlier today you said something like, we repress what we identify as uncomfortable, and we kind of, do you think the unconscious in that way is kind of like a dumping ground for what we're trying to avoid, or how would you describe that?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way.
Well, you said it, so yeah, it was good.
Yeah, I think even when Circled Hope was kind of just this dream, the one thing that I longed for was a church that didn't coerce people. I had seen too much harm, even at that point in my journey. I worked a lot with adolescents when I was younger, and yeah, just a lot of harm from pressuring people, not just about religion, but about so many things. And it seemed to me that that was a fruitless enterprise, and so many people were just marching down that road all the time. And I found it much more enlivening to try to form relationships with people, get to know them, and then it seemed a natural conversation to talk about the things that weren't working in their life, the reasons behind those, the pains, and all that. And it just kind of developed in layers that you're... Well, it goes back to some of just even my understanding of the scripture. When Paul talks about doing the things that he doesn't want to do and not doing the things that he loves, it seems to me that it paints this picture of that we are beings that are more than we know, and there's good and bad involved in that, and that one of the great gifts of having Christ become incarnate and come to dwell within us is this redemption of our own inner world, as well as ultimately the remaking of heaven and earth. So I just had this propensity. I wanted to get into the deep stuff.
Mm. And some of the deep stuff I heard you talk about before was actually getting, one step is like getting to know those things that we're afraid of, that we were repressed or we're ashamed of. And would you actually say that you think the work is like befriending those things about us as a point of contact with God? Or how does that work
absolutely.
In your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. which author will I tell you about? Let's go with Warren Kelsey first. He is a Jungian, and was. He can't still be alive. I met him when he was 75. So, but he wrote a book that actually Richard Foster referenced in that very old book now, The Celebration of Discipline. And that became a really important book for a lot of us. I lived communally through the 80s with a bunch of folks out in California where we were doing some church planting. And I think what Foster did for us was invite us in to a language that we sort of had lost. It was certainly in ancient Christianity, but it was not in the Christianity of the 70s and 80s, about the spiritual disciplines, the practice, that you could do some things to open yourself up to God, to allow the Spirit, and to know yourself better. And anyway, he referenced Martin Kelsey in this book called The Other Side of Silence. And this was pre-Amazon, pre-any of that stuff. And so I went on a search to try to find The Other Side of Silence. And meanwhile, I become clinically depressed and went to see a therapist and was sitting on her couch talking one day, and she was really bad quiet. She was talking to me, I think, and I looked at her and I looked back and I was reading all the titles in her bookshelf, and there was The Other Side of Silence, and it was like out of print. I just stood up and walked over to her bookshelf and pulled it out, and I said, "This, may I borrow this?" And so I started reading that, and what Kelsey does that I don't think some of the more popular folks now who've become popular, Thomas Keating, Richard Rohr, all those guys that are advocates of centering prayer, which is wonderful. But what Keating talked about first, or I'm sorry, what Warren Kelsey talks about is image prayer. And he's this Jungian guy, so he's all about the shadow. And how you, how we all, because of the way we're made up, go through this process of shying away from the things about us that we would call taboo, that we would not welcome. And so we sat down for a cup of tea and started talking about your dreams. We, you know, you'd be telling me all kinds of things about yourself, and I'd get you talking to me about what you thought this meant or that meant. And ultimately, what we would be doing is trying to understand what your unconscious is constructing of the bits and pieces of your life that get worked out in dreams when we're asleep. The anxieties that rise up, the way they take these fantastical forms and all of that stuff. But in the midst of it, it's still you, right? It's your unconscious. And trying to understand what's happening at these deeper places in ourselves where we have sort of forbidden ourselves to know ourselves. Because it's painful, and I don't mean that like some grand elevated suffering. It is the stuff of which we are horrified. It's the stuff that we didn't manage to process in our growing up. It's the stuff that we do not know about ourselves. That's the thing. And it struck me that in my own process of contemplative prayer, I came in through that door. So in this kind of practice, you quiet yourself, but if an image kind of floats up a little like a dream, you go with it. And for me, this became enormously healing. I, in the earlier talk that I was giving, I talked about how I had learned to value male over female in my entire world, even in swimming, because I, yes, trained extensively, and it meant absolutely nothing. There were pre-Title IX, you didn't get any scholarship, you didn't get anything. You had people look at you weird because I was way more muscular than most of the young men I knew. And so in that world, you know, I don't think I read Betty Friedan when I was 18. That was the first wave of feminism. And so I've written all those waves too, but it somehow didn't pierce this place in me that really involved the self-loathing process. I was not male. I could swim faster than my brother, who was 3 years older than me, but I was not him. And when I became a Christian, I was not male. And, you know, you weren't supposed to want to talk in the ways that I talked and read and articulate. You were supposed to, I don't know, you know, women with wiles was the thing. I was really bad at all that, so didn't go there. But in the mix of all of that, I think God insisted that I befriend those parts of me that I did not know, even to the point of finally recognizing that I hated my femininity, that I had not found worth, and that I was devaluing that which God had given me. And that was a weird journey, and I was like, wow, this is too much, you know, kind of fantastic. But I came to believe that it was absolutely essential that I allow God to work on these parts of my life. And, you know, coming around the bend then and coming to Circle of Hope over these last 20 years, I think I've said this in other environments, but I feel like it's been such a privilege to live among you all and to be valued for what I always wanted to give, rather than, I still feed a lot of people, but, you know, the kinds of stuff that was more prescribed by the culture and prescribed by my own inner world, I came to find out. So it was very important for me to learn how to embrace the monsters, because they would appear first as monsters, really, the bad stuff. And to allow that God could love me, even if I came to understand that I was really crappy at loving other people. And that seemed to be the thing I wanted to do most, and I had to own up to how really bad at it I was.
That's beautiful. I think the way that you're describing contemplative prayer, and the way that you have before, drew me to it. Even there would be times where you would sit with me, and you're a good listener, and you know how to listen in very even specific technique kind of ways. But the one I remember particularly was just listening. I'm on the brink of trying to make a big decision about some stuff. And you, the way you listened was to just see where God's kind of poking, where there's areas where I'm probably like, no, no, that's not the relevant part. And you would bring them up for me. And I've heard you describe silence as being so critical to not just developing that awareness or that skill, but even for God using it to transform you. How does silence play a role in your spiritual life?
Good answer.
How does that work for you? I think that I go back to Thomas Keating on this one, because Keating and some other dear monks of the world have really revitalized the practice of silent centering prayer. And I leaned into my mind a lot and lived a lot from my head. And I didn't think I was very smart, so I'm not sure how that all got going, but I really lived out of my head to the point that I was not even accessing my heart, my feelings, my intuition even. And one of the things that Keating works with is how, and I think I was saying a lot of this same kind of thing in the talk in the 5 o'clock meeting, but that we sort of learn ways that we think are going to achieve happiness for us, these strategies for happiness. And we learn them, unfortunately, out of our deficit places, out of, not that people were out to get us so much, but they just missed some of our needs, and out of these places where we are in pain, grief, loss, that deep sense of neglect, or perhaps it's you can fill in the blank for yourselves, but in my case, it had a lot to do with this sense of neglect and of being overlooked. And so I had lots of thoughts about all of that, and lots of thoughts about how God met me in the Gospels. But it was all right here in my head. And so I sat in the silence. The imaged prayer was really important to surprise me with the sorts of things I had to surrender, let go to God, to lay the burden down. But I think what the silence does is takes me then beyond my mind, beyond myself even. Dear Henry Nouwen, got him on your wall. One of his older books, The Way of the Heart, is talking about what the desert mothers and fathers, those faithful folks of the early centuries of the church, were doing when they escaped into the desert. they were, the idea, it's called the way of the heart, because you sort of have to let your prayer descend from your head to your heart. And it's that, whatever that is, 18 inches, that's the toughest journey of any life. And so I cannot articulate what silence does. The pause wasn't clever.
Oh, but it was.
My mouth is off. But it's... I'll tell you one brief story. I was sitting... I have a little tiny room in my house that's good for nothing else except prayer. It's designed that way when we built in the attic. I wanted this little tiny space so I could close the door and just have these few square feet dedicated. And so it's been an enormously helpful kind of tool to have. And when I was studying, when I was in the midst of my doctorate, which I mightily resisted getting, I told God he literally had to prove to me how it would not take a penny out of my family's income. Anyway, on and on again. And so all that worked out. And so I was in the middle of this thing. And everybody, I think, who does a doctorate, at least this is what I tell my doctoral students now, you get to a place where you are sure you are on the dark side of the moon. There is no light. And you just keep plodding along. And I felt that way. And I kind of was drifting back into these old habits of self-disregard because my life was so busy. And it dawned on me that what was saving my life was just sitting in the silence a few hours each morning. And that I may not know what it's doing. I may not be able to chart it. But that this silence was more important than anything I would read. That being able to sit with people and hold pain, to sit with people and understand the detail of their wounds, to sit with people and help them find the way to bring words to that which has previously been unspoken because of its depth of importance, I would say, as well as fear and grief and loss. To do that, I just knew I had to be in this place where God could get at me with as much permission as I could muster. And that's what the silence is. It's as much of me trying to get open as I can muster for any day.
And you're talking about sitting with people, and that's getting us towards some of your work, and specifically a circle counseling director and as a psychologist yourself. Now that you're, I don't know if the dust has quite settled on your retirement yet, but I know that the 20-year anniversary of circle counseling is a pretty excellent thing and a big deal. And what are some of the things that you hope circle counseling is becoming? What do you hope that circle counseling is providing?
Hope. Hope heals us. And it doesn't take away the realities of what we endure and what we need to endure and what we sacrifice and what we need to sacrifice and what we hold dear and what we find strength in, life-giving kinds of things. So, yeah, I think circle counseling is people who have been trained and who keep collaborating together, because we try to talk a lot. It's harder now that there's so many of us, but we keep working at that. To hold, to be about container, I think, a place for people to explore those parts of themselves that they don't know, that are in the dark, that are in the shadows, and that need to find expression for them to grow and become all God intends them to be. I'll often tell someone sitting in my office with me, if they're really despairing, they're fighting depression or anxiety, and have been for sometimes a very long time, I often say something like, you know, the depression itself might be our friend, because it's trying to help us get at something that needs to change deep within you. And until we can figure that out, it may hang around for a while, and we've got to learn to listen to that. Listen to that sorrow, listen to that fear, listen to that anger, because you're in it. You're in there, and I want to meet you. And so that's what we work on.
And that's beautiful. We're about to wrap up, but I want to ask you just a few kind of lighter questions. They're a little more personal, but I think as you're getting ready for a question, maybe, what's a film that you've seen over the last year that you think was like, that is a film that touches my heart, and that's something
that's so easy. 2 days ago, go see Wonder. Run.
Oh, yeah.
Don't stop. Just go see it. It's great. And it's so sappy, and nobody blows up anything. One scene where there's a little explosion.
But, I was like, uh-oh, I'm not going to pay attention to this whole thing.
It's just sweet all the way through. And the tagline is, a good friend is hard to find. But I can tell you about an older movie, really, really, really old movie that actually became one of our proverbs here. It's called Equus. It's about this kid who blinds a bunch of horses and his psychologist. I saw this when it came out. That really dates me, because I think it's like 1976. The star in the movie is Richard Burton, long dead Richard Burton. But at one point, he looks dead into the camera, so giant faces on the screen. And ultimately, what you're learning is why this kid blinds the horses, and it has to do with what he worships. And so for the psychiatrist, the dilemma is, am I going to take away this kid's worship and make him normal? And he looks dead in the screen, and he says, without worship, we shrink. I love that. I walked out of that movie and I looked at Ron and I just said, oh my God, did you hear that? That was Hollywood. Without worship, we shrink.
Mm-hmm. One of my regrets of the last couple of years is I didn't go to see the play, because Daniel Radcliffe, aka Harry Potter, was starring as the wild boy in this play. And I was like, oh, that would have been that's on my Gwen bucket list still. So one day it'll come here. Harry Potter will be back. That's a good way to change gears, I think. Are there any questions that you want to ask, or an insight you want to share, or an anecdote? Tevin.
It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And I love to ask you about if you have a way to sort of wrap up your sense of the balance or the dance or the tug of war between inner work, the inward work, the inward journey, faith journey, and the outward justice work being God's hands in the world. I feel like those can get pitted against each other, as if, because we have these scarcity mentalities, or we have these either or concepts, or all, you know. And we've heard ones like, put the mask on yourself before putting a mask on someone else, or, you know, there's all these little
quippy things.
Ideas right? about the balance, but what's just your thoughts about the balance or the dance?
Well, unfortunately, I hope this doesn't sound like a dodge, but I am always in awe of God's infinite creativity in human beings. And I love this community because I think we work at the balance between the individual and the community, and I hope we always will. But my answer would be, yeah, each person's got to figure that one out on their own through communication with others, but there is not a way for me to know what God is at work in you about, except that you tell me. Or maybe you keep talking to me about little things and we piece it together. I may reflect back to you some things so you can find it. But I really think that's an important dance. Another really old book by Elizabeth O'Connor is called Journey Inward, Journey Outward. I think they must be together. And we all probably just slip and slide around on this, trying to come to balance, which is my new unfavorite word, because I don't think I ever, we don't really balance, because, you know, if you're balanced, you know, I think about teeter-totters or whatever you're balanced on. Maybe I should think about being balanced on a surfboard. That might work better. Because I'm just, you know, it's tenuous at best, right? And you're going to fall off because it's going to be the end of the wave and you got to swim back out again. And you're going to have to re-achieve it. And I think that's the way life is. And there will be seasons when there is more about the outward journey that's happening. And then there will be seasons, even in prayer life. I talked about my imaged prayer. I had this, maybe it was a 2-year period when I first came upon this, The Other Side of Silence book, where I would walk from our house to the building we had built for the church, which was like 0.2 miles. But our house was a pretty busy place. There were 24 of us. I had 4 boys. And, you know, other people's kids were running around. It was what it was. But so I would walk early in the morning before my guys woke up and go over to the building. And I would go upstairs into this little quiet corner and I would sit and I would close my eyes and I would take a deep breath and I would begin to practice the Jesus Prayer. And I was transported. I don't know what else to say. That sounds kind of hokey. But I would literally open my eyes again and it would have been 1.5 hours. And I would start trying to write in my journal this whole imaged experience that I have had with God. And that happened for the better part of 2 years. And it was probably, and then it stopped. And I now, wait a minute, because it was so nurturing and fun and exciting, and it was like God was just leading me every step of the way. You know, there are some passages of Acts that talks about, you know, it's like they knew when to go left and when to go right because the Spirit told them, and I'm like, this is fabulous, why have I ever done this before? And then it stopped. So when I met Morton Kelsey, that was my question. Why did this stop? Why did this stop? I couldn't make it happen. And he patted my hand, smiled at me, and said, oh, you just didn't need it anymore. And I thought, it's the most obnoxious thing. I know I still needed it. But the reason I say that is that things change. Our life really does go in these cycles. And maybe I'm even reflecting just on what it's like to be a woman in an aging body. I can't do what I used to do. I used to be able to dive into a pool and feel like I never needed to stop. That is really not true anymore. And so I'm going to have to figure out what it means to be me in a body that isn't. I've had a remarkable run of health and strength. You know, I gave birth to 4 boys in less than 4 years. I could move mountains. You just let's get this done.
Yeah.
know, and did a lot. And now I know I'm in a period where I have to learn a new kind of being. So, yeah, that was a long answer, but I think it really takes this process of opening to God, because it's just going to change. You'll get it down and you'll...
Is there anyone else? We have a couple minutes, Joe. Aaron.
Yeah. This is different prayers today, speaking prayer of other people's gathering for the next prayer. As she teaches a lot of people, she said, you know, the things that hopefully more gatherings come as we get to meet more people.
Thank you for that. I'm hoping that more guidance will come. So we have to meet more people. That's cool.
I have a lighter question. Which grandchild is your favorite?
Which?
Just kidding. How many do you have? How many grandchildren?
I have 9 favorites.
Good answer. Is that...
is that cool?
No, his... grandparenting has made my parents feel extremely limited and feeling their age more.
Oh.
Has that been your situation or something different?
Yeah, gosh, that sounds horrible. My situation has been different from that. Yeah, I don't think I can still outrun Brendan, but I think I can outrun the rest of them. Still. I wouldn't want to put myself to the test on that. It's just been delightful. I have loved being a grandparent. I think I'm going to come into that more. My eldest turns 11 a week from Monday, my oldest grandchild. So he's right at the cusp of wanting to have nothing to do with me, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm just really struggling with that, you know, just what that will mean. Because it's been so fun to love him. Grandparenting is really freeing. You just don't have a lot of the guilt stuff that parents have. And, you guys are trying to parent your kids. You got to carry all that stuff. And you just, there's nothing like the greeting of a 2-3-year-old, you know, Nana! It's like you hung a loom. And for a while, I'll take that. I'll hung a loom. So, that's it. Grandparenting is great. But your kids are a little older, so your parents may be living into something that's ahead for me. I think I will notice that. Although this lake, this summer on my lake, I could throw them all off the floating dock easily. So I can still, especially if I get them in water, I can take them all. Okay.
Is there one more? Anna.
I guess I have a question about the mechanics of prayer. Speaking as someone who lives in my head, like I have not traversed the, 18 inches?
Yeah, that 18 inches.
Other than the obvious, but sit there inside.
Yeah.
Do you have any,
I love the Jesus prayer because it gives me a place to focus my overactive mind. So I repeat and work at that. And I think it's worth reading some things. If you really have trouble, you might just need more theory. So I'd read The Invitation to Love by Thomas Keating. I'd read The Way of the Heart by Henry Nouwen. I'd read Into the Silent Lands. Is that right, Martin?
Martin there.
Just because they'll give you a whole variety of ways to look at it. But I really think it's just most important to at least back to balance, not balance. I like to give myself time to express what I need to express to God. So I don't just do silent prayer, right? And for me, some of that still involves writing. I've been keeping a journal since I became a Christian. And it's really clarifying, helpful. When I put words around things, and I think this is a little bit of why therapy works, it's a container, it's a limiter, right? If I can express it, it feels like I've captured it or named it somehow. There's something about that naming process. And so, yeah, journaling for me has always been helpful. But then I've learned to try to put it all aside. When I'm in a really difficult time, as this summer turned out to be for our family, I set a timer so that I can just keep my butt in the chair, and you know, and no matter how many times I catch myself ending up making my grocery list, I just come back to the Jesus prayer until the chime goes off. And it's only in retrospect that you see whatever it is that God does.
That's really beautiful and helpful. Thank you. Gwen, thank you so much.
Yeah.
For your leadership.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.